Welcome to The Site of the Crime, your weekly Florida and federal criminal case law update podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky of Shorstein, Lesnetsky & Guy. And each week, I'm going to release one episode reviewing the previous week's Florida DCA and Florida Supreme Court decisions, and one episode reviewing the previous week's 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So whether you're on your way to court, taking a jog, or otherwise have some time to spare, join me each week to get your dose of the latest criminal case opinions. All right, welcome back to the Site of the Crime podcast. This is our federal case law update for October 10th through October 14th, 2022. And we have a pretty light docket this week. We only have five cases to talk about. No published decisions out of the 11th Circuit this week, so only five unpublished 11th Circuit decisions. So let's jump right in with the first case, Pagan v. United States. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released October 14, 2022. And Pagan is a distribution of heroin and fentanyl resulting in death, jury instruction, and admissibility of co-conspirator statements case. Ms. Pagan was charged with selling heroin and fentanyl to Jacqueline Bonifacio, who then sold it to Kaylee Jones. And Kaylee Jones died. In count one, Ms. Pagan was charged with conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute 1 kilo or more of heroin and fentanyl. And in count two, she was charged with distribution of heroin and fentanyl, resulting in death. Ms. Jones died of an overdose, and evidence tracked the controlled substances back to Bonifacio and then to Ms. Pagan. Some of the evidence admitted at trial included testimony from Ms. Bonifacio, text messages between the victim and Ms. Bonifacio, and evidence related to Ms. Bonifacio and Ms. Pagan, and testimony that the controlled substance sold to the victim had xylazine in it. Xylazine is a veterinary tranquilizer that is an unusual cutting agent. Xylazine was also found in controlled substances that Ms. Pagan later sold in a more controlled setting and controlled buys. At trial, the government introduced an officer's testimony about text messages between the victim and Bonifacio. Ms. Pagan objected on hearsay grounds. The government argued that the text messages, the content in the text messages was not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and therefore wasn't hearsay. The district court allowed it because Ms. Bonifacio was scheduled to testify and could be cross-examined about the text messages. Ms. Pagan conceded at trial that there was a conspiracy, but disputed the amount of the heroin that was involved and disputed that the victim died from her drugs. The district court gave a Pinkerton instruction on co-conspirator liability. The judge instructed the jury the following. During a conspiracy, if a conspirator commits a crime to advance the conspiracy towards its goals, then in some cases a co-conspirator may be guilty of the crime, even though the co-conspirator did not participate directly in the crime. If you have first found the defendant guilty of the crime of conspiracy as charged in count one, you may also find the defendant guilty of the crime charged in count two, even though the defendant did not personally participate in the crime. Ms. Pagan objected to this jury instruction, conceding that Pinkerton is law, but she wanted to preserve the issue. Ms. Pagan was convicted by a jury, and she appealed to the 11th Circuit. On appeal, Ms. Pagan argued that the Pinkerton instruction was improper because it allowed her to be convicted of the substantive offense involving fentanyl in count two, even if it found her guilty of conspiracy to distribute only heroin in count one. But because she didn't make this specific argument at the trial court level, the 11th looked only for plain error. Either way, the court found that the trial court did not plainly err, or err at all, in giving the Pinkerton instruction, because the court concluded that the instruction did not allow the jury to convict her of the substantive offense in count one, but a different conspiracy in count two. A Pinkerton instruction allows a jury to find a defendant guilty of a substantive offense committed by co-conspirators during and in furtherance of the conspiracy, even if the defendant did not directly participate in the substantive offense. As the court held in United States v. Silvestri, each party to a continuing conspiracy may be vicariously liable for some substantive criminal offenses committed by a co-conspirator during the course and in furtherance of the conspiracy, notwithstanding the party's non-participation in the offenses or lack of knowledge thereof. For liability to attach, the substantive offense must be a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the conspiracy. A district court does not err in giving a Pinkerton instruction if the evidence was sufficient for a reasonable jury to have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that the substantive counts were reasonably foreseeable consequences of the conspiracy alleged in the indictment. Here, both counts alleged heroin and fentanyl. The jury instructions were given in the disjunctive, however, using the word or between heroin or fentanyl, allowing the jury to find Ms. Pagan guilty of conspiracy to distribute heroin or fentanyl. Where an indictment charges in the conjunctive several means of violating a statute, like here, heroin or fentanyl, a conviction may be obtained on proof of only one of the means, heroin or fentanyl, and accordingly, the jury instruction may properly be framed in the disjunctive, heroin or fentanyl, as opposed to heroin and fentanyl, which was charged in the indictment. So Ms. Pagan argues that the jury could have believed that there were two separate conspiracies, one involving heroin and one involving fentanyl, and it could have found her guilty of conspiracy to distribute fentanyl, but distribution of heroin in a separate conspiracy, which would have held her vicariously liable for a substantive offense carried out in furtherance of a different conspiracy. However, the 11th Circuit rejected this argument, finding that the jury had to conclude that Ms. Pagan conspired to distribute a controlled substance in count one, and therefore the jury could find her guilty of distributing a controlled substance in count two. In the 11th's view, Ms. Pagan took too narrow of an approach. Even if the jury found that the co-conspirators to the conspiracy in count one intended to distribute only heroin, the jury still could have found that the co-conspirator, Bonifacio, sold the fentanyl that caused the death in furtherance of the same conspiracy. Even if it were two different drugs in the substantive count and the conspiracy count, it was all the same conspiracy, according to the 11th. Ms. Pagan also challenged the district court's decision to admit the co-conspirator text messages because she argued that they were inadmissible hearsay and introduced to prove the matter asserted. Under Federal Rule 801, subsection C, an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted is hearsay. Statements offered as a basis for inferring something other than the matter asserted are not hearsay. So if the statement is admitted for its effect on the listener, or if the statement is an order or request, and to a large degree not capable of being true or false, then it's not hearsay. Also, under Federal Rule of Evidence 801, subsection D2E, statements used against a party made by a party's co-conspirator during and in furtherance of the conspiracy are not hearsay. For a co-conspirator statement to be admissible, the government must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that number one, a conspiracy existed, number two, the conspiracy included the declarant and the defendant against whom the statement is offered, and number three, the statement was made during the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. Here, the 11th Circuit held that the text messages contained no hearsay. Text messages sent by Bonifacio were co-conspirator statements, according to the court. These text messages related to the heroin sales and were therefore in furtherance of the conspiracy. And one string of messages relating to the victim picking up medication for Bonifacio at a pharmacy that was unrelated to the conspiracy was determined to be harmless error. Even if those messages showed that the phone number of the phone used belonged to Bonifacio, there was ample other evidence to establish that fact. So no harm, no foul. and the text messages sent to Bonifacio from the victim were not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, according to the court. Text messages sent from the victim requesting drugs and arranging pickup times was more in the nature of an order or request and incapable of being proven true or false. They were offered to show their effect on the listener, Bonifacio, and to provide context for Bonifacio's text responses. Therefore, they were not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted and not hearsay. Case affirmed. Our second case today is United States v. Anderson. This is a 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released October 14, 2022. And Anderson is a sophisticated means enhancement case. Mr. Anderson was convicted for wire fraud, mail fraud, and conspiracy to commit wire fraud and mail fraud. At sentencing, the district court applied a two-level enhancement under Section 2B1.1, subsection B10C, for sophisticated means. 2B1.1, subsection B10C, calls for a two-level enhancement in the guidelines on a fraud offense if the offense involves sophisticated means and the defendant intentionally engages in or causes the conduct constituting sophisticated means. The use of repetitive, coordinated conduct to perpetuate and conceal a fraud scheme supports a sophisticated enhancement. Moreover, the length of a scheme and the loss inflicted by it can be considered in determining whether a defendant employed sophisticated means. Mr. Anderson, to perpetuate the fraud, created a welcome letter promising an 8% return of investor funds used to buy medical receivables. He sent investors falsified letters from a law firm purporting to hold funds in escrow. He falsified letters of protection from lawyers promising to pay proceeds upon settlement or judgment. And he provided other falsified documents. Mr. Anderson argued that the enhancement should not apply because the scheme was not overly complex. However, the 11th Circuit found that the mechanisms by which the scheme was implemented and executed were sufficiently sophisticated to support the district court's application of the guideline enhancement. The methods were repetitive, coordinated, and targeted to reassure investors and to make the scheme appear legitimate. The scheme lasted almost 3 years and resulted in a loss of $17 million, and the court found that the degree of duration and loss further evidenced the sophistication. The court also rejected Mr. Anderson's argument that the district court improperly double-counted when it applied the sophisticated means enhancement as well as an aggravating role enhancement. Impermissible double counting occurs only when one part of the guidelines is applied to increase a defendant's punishment on account of a kind of harm that has already been fully accounted for by application of another part of the guidelines. Here, the 11th Circuit found that the sophisticated means enhancement, which arises from a defendant's complex or intricate conduct, is distinct from the extent of the defendant's role in the offense. The court then looked at the substantive reasonableness of Mr. Anderson's sentence and determined that even though his sentence was higher than his co-defendant's, it was justified based on his greater criminal history and his level of culpability. Case affirmed. Our third case today is United States v. Pope Jr. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released October 13, 2022. And Pope is a probation officer search and seizure case involving a warrantless search of a probationer's home. Mr. Pope was on probation for two state felony convictions in Alabama. Conditions of his probation included reporting to the probation officer as directed, permitting the probation officer to visit his home, to visit him at his home or elsewhere, to submit to searches by the probation officer of his person, residence, vehicle, or any other property under his control, and to not possess, receive, or transport firearms. While on probation, Mr. Pope failed to report for two consecutive months, So two probation officers visited his home. Mr. Pope's wife told the officers that he wasn't home, but his young daughter said he was inside. Miss Pope clearly had never heard the old English proverb, "Children and fools tell the truth." Armed with this conflicting information, the probation officers walked into the garage and into the home and found Mr. Pope lying face down on a bed. The probation officers eventually woke him up, and he appeared to be under the influence of something, slurring his words. The probation officers handcuffed Mr. Pope and searched his room, finding a pump-action shotgun in an open closet. The probation officers seized the gun, read Mr. Pope Miranda, and took him to jail. Mr. Pope was indicted in federal court for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. He filed the motion to suppress the firearm, arguing that the search violated both the Fourth Amendment and Alabama law. The district court denied the motion, and Mr. Pope entered a conditional plea reserving his right to appeal. The Supreme Court, in United States v. Knights, recognized an exception to the warrant and probable cause requirements for a probationer who has agreed to submit to searches as a condition of his probation. The reasonableness of a search is determined by assessing, on the one hand, the degree to which it intrudes upon an individual's privacy, and on the other hand, the degree to which it is needed for the promotion of legitimate governmental interests. Probationers have a diminished expectation of privacy because they do not enjoy the absolute liberty to which every citizen is entitled. In Knights, the Supreme Court held that no more than reasonable suspicion is required for law enforcement to search a probationer's home without a warrant when a probation condition authorizes such searches. So the probation officers only needed reasonable suspicion of a probation violation to conduct a warrantless search. In United States v. Yuknovich, the 11th Circuit has held that reasonable suspicion consists of a sufficiently high probability that criminal conduct is occurring to make the intrusion on the individual's privacy interest reasonable. And the court must take stock of everything the officer knew before searching. Here, the probation officers knew that Mr. Pope failed to report for 2 months. There were conflicting accounts about whether he was inside the residence. There were two other men inside the garage, all giving the officers reasonable suspicion that Mr. Pope was evading probation officers. Because there was reasonable suspicion, and because his probation order included a search condition, it was reasonable for the officers to enter Mr. Pope's home without a warrant. When the probation officers observed Mr. Pope unresponsive with slurred speech, reasonable suspicion that he was under the influence of drugs developed, which was another violation. Therefore, it was reasonable for the probation officers to search his room for contraband. Mr. Pope also argued that the probation officers acted outside their geographical jurisdiction. Generally, federal law governs the admissibility of evidence obtained by state officers in federal court. Whether the state law authorizes a given search is irrelevant for the court's Fourth Amendment analysis. Because the search was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, whether it was authorized by state law is irrelevant. Mr. Pope also argued that the search was unreasonable in the way it was conducted. But under the plain view doctrine, an officer may conduct a warrantless seizure when, number one, an officer is lawfully located in the place from which the seized object could be plainly viewed and must have a lawful right to access to the object itself, and number two, the incriminating character of the item is immediately apparent. Here the officers were lawfully in the residence, and the shotgun was in plain view in an open closet, and the incriminating nature was immediately apparent as Mr. Pope was not allowed to possess a firearm as a condition of his probation. Mr. Pope also argued that he was presented with a probation order that was not signed by the judge, but the 11th Circuit quickly rejected this argument, finding that the order he was presented with was identical to the one signed by the judge, and there was no case law presented to the court that shows that he was required to be provided with a signed copy of his probation order prior to the judge signing it. or with the judge signing it prior to him obtaining it and signing it. Mr. Pope finally argued that under Alabama law, the officers needed a written statement of his probation violation. However, the 11th Circuit pointed out that this requirement was only if the supervising probation officer doesn't personally make the arrest, whereas here the supervising probation officer did personally make the arrest. Therefore, all of Mr. Pope's arguments were rejected. Case affirmed. Our fourth case today is United States v. Eula. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision released October 12, 2022. And Eula is a career offender enhancement case. Mr. Eula objected to his base offense increase of 63 to 78 months, increased up to 151 to 188 months, based on a career offender designation under Section 4B1.1 subsection A of the guidelines. The district court overruled the objection and sentenced Mr. Eula to 151 months, which was the bottom of his guidelines as a career offender. The district court specifically stated that it would have sentenced Mr. Eula to the same sentence even if he had not qualified as a career offender. This is called a Keene statement, and on appeal, the appellate court will look at the reasonableness of the sentence had the guidelines been calculated at the objected to level, in this case, 63 to 78 months. Based on his criminal history, which included felonies for multiple bank robberies and five separate prison sentences, Mr. Eula's sentence of 151 months would have been reasonable even if his guidelines were the lower 63 to 78 months. So, case affirmed. Our fifth and final case today is United States v. Zimmerman. This is an 11th Circuit unpublished decision that was released October 13, 2022. Zimmerman is a child pornography case involving admission of a prior conviction at trial and preventing access to the internet as a condition of supervised release. During his trial for possession of child pornography, the government admitted a prior conviction for the same offense that Mr. Zimmerman obtained 25 years earlier. Mr. Zimmerman objected and the district court overruled the objection. On appeal, the 11th Circuit considered whether the district court erred in admitting the prior conviction. Under Rule 403 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, a court can exclude relevant evidence if its probative value is substantially outweighed by its risk of unfair prejudice. Rule 403 is narrowly circumscribed, and it is an extraordinary remedy to exclude evidence under this rule that should be used sparingly. Rule 414 states that when a defendant is accused of an offense of child molestation, evidence of his prior offense of child molestation is admissible and may be considered for its bearing on any relevant matter. Possession of child pornography is a child molestation offense under this rule. However, evidence admitted under Rule 414 must still satisfy Rule 403. So the probative value from the prior conviction cannot be substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. The 11th Circuit has affirmed the admission of a defendant's prior acts where they were probative of the defendant's interest in child pornography and made it more likely that the defendant, rather than some other person, was responsible for child pornography found on the computers. Here, the 11th Circuit held that Mr. Zimmerman's prior 25-year-old conviction also was admissible under Rule 414 and was not inadmissible under Rule 403. The district court only allowed the conviction and not the underlying details from the prior offense. And the district court did not have to apply a multi-factor balancing test that is applied in other circuits because that is not the law in the 11th Circuit. The prior conviction was probative because it showed Mr. Zimmerman's intent and nature of his interest in child pornography. And it showed that it was more likely that he knowingly possessed the devices containing child pornography And it was less likely that he was unaware of the child pornography or that someone else put it there. The court also found that the prior conviction was probative despite being 25 years old because of the nature of the two crimes and his attempt to characterize his prior offense as involving only depictions of nudity as opposed to child pornography. Therefore, the court held that the district court properly admitted the 25-year-old conviction. The court next turned to a provision of Mr. Zimmerman's supervised release that prohibited him from accessing the internet. In Packingham, the Supreme Court held that a North Carolina law violated the First Amendment by making it a felony for a registered sex offender to access a social networking website that the offender knew permitted children to become members or create personal pages. In Bobel, the 11th Circuit rejected an argument that a district court committed plain error under Packingham by imposing a restriction on computer usage as a special condition of supervised release, reasoning that Packingham did not address the constitutionality of conditions on supervised release. Mr. Zimmerman did not raise his objection to the internet restriction at the trial level, so the 11th Circuit reviewed it for plain error. Because the law of the land in the 11th Circuit is that a district court can restrict computer usage as a condition of supervised release, there was no plain error. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court decides to extend Packingham to supervised release provisions remains to be seen. Case affirmed. And that's a wrap. I'm your host, Jeremy Lesnetsky with Shorstein, Lesnetsky & Guyon. And this was another episode of the Site of the Crime podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the like button. And if you'd like to keep up to date on all the latest criminal law cases, subscribe to the Site of the Crime. And if you like the show, please review us. This will help your colleagues find us, and they too can stay up to date. Each week, we'll release separate Florida and federal criminal law episodes with the previous week's court opinions. Look in the episode description for timestamps for each case in each jurisdiction. Thanks for joining us at the Site of the Crime.